Tommy Whittington is a scholar and an activist living in Troy. His work focuses on Black resistance in the U.S., especially the genesis of the Black Lives Matter movement. This is part two of a two-part interview, with the first half is available online.
Let's talk a little bit about the mass incarceration thing.
Sure.
Because you did say that some of these organizations who ended up being a part of Black Lives Matter, mm-hmm. but had been doing work before, were focusing in areas of mass incarceration,
sure.
and policing well before famous events like the death of Mike Brown.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if we could talk a little bit about the history of mass incarceration as it relates to like Black resistance.
Right. And so I've been thinking about this. As I said before, I do historical sociology. And one thing I kind of think that people get wrong, and the more I think about it, and the more I kind of look around the Black diaspora, I think Black resistance is just a thing, right? It's just like a thing that's going to happen. And it's just like a part of our society, because the countries in the New World were largely founded as slave societies, right? And so it's just like the way that the game's set up is that Black resistance is going to happen just the same way that labor activism is just a part of the country, gender activism. Think like this is just always going to happen without end. It's just a question of what the context is. And I think that mass incarceration and I think over-policing provide the very real historical and institutional context that we saw the past 3-4 years of Black activism occurring. And as I was kind of looking back, I was looking at this rereading this great article by Pamela Oliver, who's a professor at the University of Wisconsin. And she makes the argument, following a few other scholars, namely Gary Marks, who focuses on policing in the 60s, that the kind of contemporary episode of mass incarceration isn't because the war on drugs. It actually is kind of occurs as a response to the 60s riots and 60s activism and the kind of changes in laws of be it free assembly, protests, what's legal, what's arrestable, things like that, and also the very real repressive anti kind of protests actions that the government was taking. She says that those protests of the 60s and riots of the 60s increased a policing and increased arrests, right? But that for Black communities, that policing never subsided, right? And so the kind of contemporary Black, I guess, racialized dynamic of policing that would ultimately become the kind of pretext for Black Lives Matter and the police killings of Mike Brown and Eric Garner. We should also very much note that George Zimmerman was not a police officer, and that's a whole different bag. You know, that these are, in a way, a response to the reactions of earlier waves of Black protests. Does that make sense?
Sure. So you're saying that rather than being an independent phenomenon, the racialized policing of the 80s and into today mm-hmm. was actually a direct response to Black resistance in the 60s and 70s.
Right, right. I think that, how do I say this? I wouldn't say direct, because the drug war did happen, right? Like, regime change did happen, Reagan,
sure, yeah.
so on and so forth. I would say it was you can't separate, inseparable, maybe, you know?
Right.
So it's like there are other things that happened and kind of shaped, you know, kind of in the same way that, you know, ICE is a product of the Bush regime, right? And it's like, yeah, You can't think of this without understanding the prior context of racial immigration and stuff like that. But, you know, this is all to say that a lot of people kind of understand a kind of linear increase in policing when it's actually much more contingent, right? The government didn't have to change the laws, right, to repress Black protests in the 60s, right? And riots in the 60s, but right. it did.
Right.
So it's like now we're here, right? Did you have, I'm sorry.
I have a bunch of questions. Yeah. One of them is this, do you see a relationship between the like sort of blanket like drug policing and like broken windows policing that was introduced in the 80s. Mm-hmm. And do you see a relationship between that and the like more targeted methods of COINTELPRO and similar anti-Black Power efforts?
Ooh, wow. Wow, that's a great question. I think that,
and for those who don't know, COINTELPRO was a counterintelligence program the FBI operated in order to disperse Black Power organizations in the 70s.
Who was it? Hoover, right? Who was the head of? Yeah, was it Edgar?
I think it was Edgar.
It was Edgar Hoover. That's right. So that's to say, ooh, that's a tough question. I would say that I genuinely, honestly, in my heart, believe that the 80s Republican administration, Reagan, but also just like the Republican establishment in the 80s, genuinely had a different agenda in pursuing drug trafficking and drug use. And I think that it's not necessarily a, what's the word I want to use? It's not necessarily like a directly racialized, and this is kind of how the outcomes of policies white supremacist society will tend to be white supremacists, no matter, unless you incorporate some kind of anti-racist kind of, be it affirmative action, things like that, right? I genuinely think that they enacted those policies as out of a legitimate concern for communities and for drug trafficking. I also think that those kinds of institutional powers that they granted, right, those kinds of law enforcement powers and changes that occurred in the 80s, occurred in a context that in which those the institutions were already laid on top of Black communities in a disproportionate way, right? So it's like, and we can see this in contemporary discussions of policing, in terms of drugs in particular, right? Looking at, like, we know that drug use is not necessarily, and especially at the city level, I'm thinking of recent discussions about New York. It's like, we know that drug use occurs in white communities in New York City just as much, but we also know that the arrest rates are much lower in the white communities, right? So it's like one of those things where it's like, something's wrong here. And so it's like, it's more of a layered cake, I guess would be a better, I think it's easier to understand as a layered cake than to kind of try to read into a, into the Reagan administration in the 80s, a real deep fear of like Black activism that for a lot of, I think hadn't been seen on the scale as in the 60s.
I see. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting to the narrative that you're talking about, mm-hmm. where mass incarceration of the second half of the 20th century is sort of a child of the 60s, and a sort of indirect mm-hmm. Result of the response to Black activism. Mm-hmm. And that narrative conflicts with the more popular narrative right now. The mass incarceration in the second half of the 20th mm-hmm. century is simply a development of the Jim Crow era policies.
Right.
And I wonder if you could talk about that or if you see a conflict there or not.
Yeah. I think that, and it's also interesting because there's a certain generation of Americans that we're, are quite old now that would remember kind of the full kind of waxing and waning of Black activism over most of the 20th century, right? And so kind of, starting with Garveyism, mm-hmm. Going through the World War II veterans, going through the Civil Rights era, Black Power, now we're here. And that's to say that I'm a huge fan of, how do I say this? I think that the kind of understanding of Jim Crow inevitably leading to mass incarceration or naturally leading to mass incarceration is a very cynical kind of view of history and, mm-hmm. and social change, which I'm a cynic, yes. Very sympathetic, but I think that there's so many things that didn't have to happen, right? But they did, right? So the kind of urban riots of the 60s didn't have to happen, but they did, right? The ensuing federal government and state government's responses to riots. They didn't have to happen that way, but they did. And I think that there's episodes in the history, the civil rights movement, right, that are surrounded by episodes of Black activism, right? So what happened between Garveyism in the early days of the NAACP and the civil rights movement, right? What happened between the end of the Black Power era and Black Lives Matter, you know, if you want to kind of go the more cultural route, you could also definitely talk about the kind of black consciousness kind of movement of the early 90s that brought us like Public Enemy, things like that, right? But that's to say that there's Jim Crow in the kind of policies and ways of policing black people and keeping them out of public space and subservient were a different kind of institutional logic, right? And so it was a either legally codified, right, in race laws, right, in the Southeast, right, segregation laws, right, or informally enforced, right? So yeah, this law on paper, we're supposed to serve you, we're supposed to give you tickets to the movie theater, but whenever black people show up, we decide to close up shop, right? Mass incarceration is a different, it's literally a different institution, right? It's different laws, right? And so I think it's really important not to conflate kind of either legal or functional segregation with the kind of maybe more benevolent or colorblind logic that allows black people to be incarcerated in astronomical rates, even so much that society is literally warped, like racially warped, right? By legal standards, right? And so it's like these things were both legal, right? But it's like the way that they are done, be it in Jim Crow through like jobs and employment service, right? It's not the same thing as putting people away. You could be put away for violating Jim Crow, sure, but it's not the same kind of function.
I see. Mm-hmm. It sounds to me like another aspect of this is that if you draw a linear narrative between, you know, slavery to Jim Crow mm-hmm. to mass incarceration, mm-hmm. that could have the effect of erasing the nuances of black resistance strategies and the way that they affected the way, you know, the state repression. Is that true?
I think I would agree with that, right? I think it's just a question of what do you get out of the narrative, right? What is the narrative for? And so I think that there's great books, you know, be it Michelle Alexander's classic, right? Loïc Wacquant wrote about kind of these how slavery is remade over time. I think that it's useful to kind of say that, to point over a long historical span of America to kind of show how black populations have been, you know, disenfranchised. I think that that's really great. And I think that's really important to kind of get people to the beginning of the conversation, right? Of saying, well, what does structural racism look like? So on and so forth. I think at the end, though, it's like at some point you have to get to the nitty gritty. And I think that people that are focusing on like doing this change and doing anti-racist work are a lot more kind of at that end of saying like, we know structural racism exists. These are kind of assumptions before we kind of do the work. But it's more of, okay, if I'm a and so I think a good example is thinking about what the tactics that like Southern Christian Leadership coalition we're doing, Martin Luther King, so on and so forth, we're doing in the South versus kind of Northern tactics, right? Or the tactics of even the NAACP, right? And things like this, right? Those are different tactics. People use those different tactics because they had different realities on the ground. And so I think that that narrative is useful, but I think it's like once you kind of get to the nitty gritty, there's different laws and different institutions that you have to kind of put pressure on, right, in order to kind of get to hopefully make black activism successful. And so I think that, yeah, I'm here for the grand historical narratives, but I'm also like a nerd for the question of social change, right? So how do people make change? And I think that that kind of requires having a much finer kind of scope of questioning what is really making black disenfranchisement happen in this one specific place and time.
Sure. So maybe we could, with that in mind, and with the few minutes we have left, we could bring this idea back to the present. The idea that there's a dialectic relationship between black activism and state repression, and that sometimes the way that the state is oppressive is a, mm-hmm. is a response to particular strategies mm-hmm. and tactics mm-hmm. of activism. So mm-hmm. what is happening now? Mm-hmm. How has the state responded to Black Lives Matter activism? And in what ways do you see methods of oppression changing or shifting?
Oh, wow. That's a huge... so much there. I think like the common historical... The way that we learn history and the way that history is taught in, popularly in the United States is kind of this progression, right? I think the kind of... the way that sociologists kind of think of it without history and that our focus on more contemporary is kind of a lever of a back and forth struggle, like a seesaw. And I think if you combine those things, you end up with like a rhizome, right? Like a root that encounters a stone in its path and goes another way and then another rock, right? There's so much. I think Blue Lives Matter is a thing.
yeah. But is it, like, what is it? Well, that's a different question. But.
Oh, yeah. So I think that there's been a kind of a few different things, right? I personally think that, and I think that if you look at the Southern strategy and kind of that dynamic, that relationship from the Nixon campaign, right, to the Black activism that was happening at that time is interestingly paralleled with Trump. And I think that that's kind of a commentary that's been undersold of kind of what is the kind of psychological wage of the election mean, right? And what were people looking at just before the election, right? And Black Lives Matter was very much an issue since the midterms, right? Just after the midterms of 2014.
Right.
Right. I also think that it's become a cultural thing, right? And so people are really invested in the police and really think that, Black activism to kind of hold police accountable is a problem, right? And so a lot of people are really, and I think the NFL protests are a good case in point, is where people are really kind of on board with forcing compliance with erasing criticism of policing by any means necessary.
Sure. Now there's the black identity extremist category the FBI's introduced.
Right. I was going to say that. And then also you have the, you have a lot of bills that are trying to classify police as a protected class, right? Mm-hmm. Under kind of like forms of hate crime legislation, things like that. Not to mention the police unions and things like that, that are all kind of going about, if not, proactively kind of protecting and building support or shielding against criticism of police, definitely retro, if the police are guilty of wrongdoing, definitely making sure those, not guilty, but accused of wrongdoing, because guilty is a very high standard, accused of wrongdoing, they also have these institutions like the police unions, so on and so forth, politicians, that will more or less kind of shield them from the legal recourse. Or make sure that they get severance pay and retirement and pension and all these things if they should leave the force. But yeah, you had another question, maybe?
That was a lot, and I think that we're almost running out of time for this conversation. Is there anything that we didn't cover that you wanted to talk about?
I think that I personally was looking at, and I did want to shout this out. There's an article in The Nation by Scott Saul, S-A-U-L, called Off Camera, Civil Rights in the North. And it has a really good analysis, kind of what we're talking about, of how black activists use the success of Brown v. Board of Education and the successes of the civil rights movement to do more black activism, right? And it's talking about the book. The book that is reviewed in the article is Sweet Land of Liberty by Thomas, I'm going to try and pronounce it, Sugru, S-U-G-R-U-E. And it talks about how, the civil rights movement didn't end with the passage of this legislation, even though it was sweeping, right? But it kind of allowed for different modes of black activism. And so I think that's kind of a really good starting point for kind of understanding a different historical framework for understanding black activism, that if you're... listeners are interested, should definitely check out the Nation article. It's not too long, and if that really compels them, to check out the book too.
Great. Well, hopefully maybe you can come back soon and talk more about that.
Yeah, I would love to. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks.
That was Tommy Weddington, local scholar and activist, in conversation with Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Jonah Moberg. Part one of that interview is available online.
That concludes our